Well, this is a real pleasure. One of my daughter's favorite authors, and certainly one of mine as well, Mr. Drew DeWalt, is with us today. Thanks so much for doing it, man.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thank you, man.
You have had such a run lately. Let's start at the beginning. Because I'm a comic book nerd, I love origin stories. Let's get back to you at the beginning. And when did you first know that you wanted to write? Now, you didn't first get into writing books, right?
Right. No, when I first, you know, I get this question from the little kids. I do school visits for my books. And my favorite answer for the kids is, do you play with action figures and toys? And all the hands go up, all our dolls and, you know, and dolls and things. And I said, well, you know, you're writing when you do little stories with your toys, right? And the kids are like, what? And it's great to see their eyes open to that moment. So, I mean, that's kind of where I placed the beginning of my writing career, is making little stories for my Star Wars action figures.
Right.
You know, my dream as a 70s child and an 80s teen was, you know, I was going to grow up and be in the next Star Wars movie at the time.
Sure, we all were.
But yeah, so I started when I was seven. I'll say seven. But when I started seriously writing was...
Did you write the stories down when you were at seven, or this was just play acting?
Play acting, and then, you know, because I count that. And then I really started writing when I was about 15, I think.
Hmm.
Yeah, because I was in school and started getting ideas for stories.
Now, there's one thing as a kid to write. I mean, a lot of us did. But at what point do you decide, okay, this is the path I'm going to take moving forward into adulthood? I mean, was there a decision? Can you remember a moment where you said, yeah, I'm going to give this a go and try to do it for a living?
Yeah. You know, I was on a path toward, you know, I was, you know, was a typical teenager. Didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up.
Sure.
And I wanted to maybe try medicine. My mom was a nurse and she said, don't do that. It's the old story of, you know, the lawyer's kids become doctors and the doctor's kids become lawyers.
Right.
In my case, mom was a nurse and said, no, don't go into medicine if you want time with your family, because she found that it was a constant thing.
So, sure.
I started studying journalism. So I decided, I actually started off at Kent State University in Ohio studying journalism. But 2 years into that, I've decided that writing political stories, I was not a poli-sci kind of person.
Mm.
It turned me off, and I really enjoyed going back to escapism in childhood, because I'm, you know, I'm like 9 years old at heart,
right?
You know, and you know, I didn't like that sort of hard hitting journalism stuff, so I decided to write my own stories. And I had a steady diet throughout my childhood and my teen years. I'm the youngest of six, and mom would go to work, and dad would go to work, and my older brothers would watch me. So at night, she'd like tell them, don't let him watch scary movies. Don't let him watch these fantasy films. It gives him nightmares, and no junk food. Mom leaves, door shuts. We're watching, you know, all these old horror movies from the 50s and 60s.
Right.
And
eating whatever you want.
And eating pizza. You know what I mean? So right out the door. So mom would come home and she'd read me Roald Dahl and Tolkien, Dr. Seuss when I was very young. So I'm getting this sort of steady diet of fantasy from mom and my brothers.
Mm.
And this sort of just coagulated into who I was going into college. So I transferred from Kent State to Emerson College in Boston.
Which is more liberal arts. Sort of
super liberal arts. And yeah. I looked at their back in the day, there was no internet. So I had to look at a pamphlet for what they taught. And they had a comedy writing class and a science fiction writing class. And I thought, man, this is for me. You know, I want to go write stories and tell and see if I can make a living at it. My major was creative writing, but my concentrations were screenwriting and in children's literature, because I thought I'm going to go work for Disney when I grow up.
Oh, that was the big plan.
That was the big plan.
So you followed the screenwriting path, right? That's eventually what you got into.
Yeah, it was actually, you know, you finish film school and you show up in Hollywood and go, okay, I'm ready to direct now. And someone says, go get me coffee, punk, you know. So I spent years making bagels and running around getting, you know, packs of Altoids for producers and opening up chairs on set and that kind of stuff.
What was your first entree into the business? Do you remember your first gig where you got to be a PA or a gopher or anything?
I'll never, ever forget it. It was 1992, fall 1992.
How long had you been in town at that point?
5 minutes. I think about a week. And my school, Emerson, helped me get the internship. And I was interning for Marcia Nassiter and Stephen Haft, producers. Stephen had done Dead Poets Society. Ralph Winter, who was partnered with them on this particular film at Disney, had done the Star Trek movies.
Wow.
And these were really A-list producers. And I was Stephen's, you know, lackey boy. And it was for the movie Hocus Pocus.
Oh, sure. Bette Midler, Kathy and Jimmy. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a wonderful time. I ended up being Bette Midler's dog sitter for 4 months.
That's showbiz, kids.
Yeah. Well, you know, I couldn't staple to save my life. I couldn't balance any of the budgets they were handing me. They were giving me like little mini budgets to balance and stuff to right. sort of practice, you know, be a producer or whatever. And I was screwing it all up and I couldn't get anything right. And I'd walk in on his meetings and I was like the worst intern in the world. I would totally have fired me, but he said, look, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to direct. He's like, well, then go hang out on set and get out of my hair. So he's like, go bother Kenny Ortega, you know? So I'm like, okay. So I go down to the studio, the building where they built the haunted house, the witch's house for Hocus Pocus inside. And it's the soundstage and everybody's filming inside the house. And I'm looking at this really long line of like 30 chairs, the director's chairs with everybody's name on it. And I'm thinking, well, you know, no one's in these. And he told me to stay out of everybody's way. So I'm going to sit down. I thought they were ceremonial. I didn't realize that these chairs were the person's chair. So I thought, oh, Bette Midler. I'll sit in Bette Midler's chair. Steven was right behind me. And he like flicks my ear and he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm just sitting there. I said, do you see the name on that chair? I'm like, yeah. And he goes, do you know what happened to you if she caught you in that chair? I'm like, no, no. And I got up and I'm like, I'm sorry. And he's like, first of all, she'd fire me and disintegrate you. But then, you know, she ended up getting word that I'd sat in her chair. I was the PA that was dumb enough to sit in her chair.
Oh, so no.
She came up to me, I don't know, like a week or so, maybe a couple days later, and was like, well, welcome to Hollywood, farm boy. Because I was from Ohio, and she'd found out. And she pretends to pick a piece of straw out of my hair. She's like, let me get that straw out of your hair. Welcome to Hollywood. But she was so kind and sweet to me, you know, and I was right. I became like sort of her go-to gopher.
Oh, that's great.
So that was my first job in Hollywood.
And you wanted to direct... And obviously you wanted to write as well because you came out of that. So what was that path like for you? Was it a struggle? Did you have success?
You know, I always tell young screenwriting students, you know, there's a real idea about protecting your work. You don't let anybody see it. You're going to get ripped off. Someone's going to steal it.
Right.
I actually had the opposite when I was 22. I was like, anyone who would read it. I was showing it to location managers, teamsters. I even showed it. I was on a movie, a really low budget movie called Reverse Heaven that never came out at a company called Crystal Sky. And I remember showing my script to the producer and director. It was the same guy, producer, director. It showed it to his mom because she was visiting set. And I'm like, do you want to read this? And she's like, yeah, sure. So he calls me into his office like a week later. He's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm like, because I was like assistant props or something on that movie. And he's right. like, you gave my mom that script. And I'm like, you know, she seemed interested. And he's like, well, she made me read it. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, Steven. And she's like, he's like, all right, look, you're a good writer. You're lucky.
If you had wasted his time, he would have been pissed.
He was pissed anyway, but he's like, luckily you're good. But he's like, my mom literally made me read your stupid script.
Your mom did coverage on your script.
Totally. That was the way to do it. So I showed my script to everybody. And I got into doing some like low budget stuff. I did a thing called Modern Day Tom Sawyer for them. It was like kids movies, Nickelodeon type stuff.
Right.
did some science fiction stuff and then, you know, got representation. My first movie that I got to write that I got a screenwriting credit on was with Sean Levy, who went on to do The Night at the Museum.
Sure, yeah.
Stranger Things and everything else. Sean's, you know, megalithic at this point.
Right.
But it was his first movie too, which was kind of cool. We were both out of college and he was filming. Like he was figuring out coverage on the day, you know, and I was doing wow. rewrites. So I was up in Salt Lake City and we had to join a club to buy a beer and it was great. but Disney found me eventually and I ended up doing some work for them on Timon and Pumbaa and Buzz Lightyear of Star Command, which was their TV shows that they had spinoffs for Disney Channel.
Right.
So that was sort of my entry into children's writing, which was kind of my goal.
Especially after your double concentration of screenwriting and children's literature, finally those two worlds were coming together and you got to work in animation, which was your goal eventually, right?
Yeah, yeah. And animation was super fun and I enjoyed writing it because I actually like the collaborative part of, you know, being able to write a script and hand it off and not worry about it anymore, you know, and I actually like that part of it. You know, I know a lot of screenwriters struggle and really they truly want to direct and I did direct some, but mostly I was screenwriting and I really enjoyed handing it off to the animators because when an animator or even an illustrator on one of my books hands me back a drawing based on something I wrote, it's like Christmas morning every single time.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, I'm 49 now, and I instantly regress to being 9 years old, opening up a new action figure. It's like, oh, look at this drawing. This is so cool. And I didn't think of it this way.
And the good ones make it so much better, you know?
Yeah. And then you get credit for it. So
I wrote a comic book called Batman Meets the Green Hornet. It was based on the old Batman TV series. And first of all, that was a dream come true because I got to put words into Adam West's mouth. But then I would hand them off to this amazing artist named Ty Templeton. And then I would see what he had done based on what ideas or suggestions I'd given. And I know exactly how you feel. It always just gave me chills to see that come to life in a way that I never even imagined.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, you know, when I'm working on a screenplay and the producer's like, well, you know, when do you want us to involve you on set or anything like that? I'm like, just call me when you're filming and I'll come to craft services and I'll get a Twizzler and I'll just watch and be all wide-eyed. I'm fine with that. I'm never lost my fanboy.
After the Disney TV stuff, what was the next step for you?
It was really, my route has been really weird. So TV animation went straight into... I had done a brief stint as a production designer and a prop master on low budget films. And I remember this PA and he was totally Spicoli. He was like, all right, dude. Okay, man. All right. And he was this very funny guy. And we were filming something in Malibu. This was in the mid-90s. And, he had to carry these ice chests up one of these cliffs at like El Matador or something. And he's like, you know, it's about a 6-story climb up these things. And he's all by himself. And he's the only PA there on set. And so I went down and helped him. And I didn't think anything of it because it's just what a decent human being does. Poor kid. Well, he calls me like 4 years later. This is after Disney. And I'm a kind of an established writer at that point. He's like, hey, man, did you still want to direct something, man? And I'm like... Yeah. And he's like, well, I'm totally a producer now. And I'm like, wow, Scott, what are you doing? He's like, you're not going to believe this, man, but I'm like one of the biggest music video producers in Europe, dude.
Wow.
And I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, MTV Europe and Viva in Germany, which is kind of like VH1, man. And he's like, you carried those ice chests up with me that day. Would you want to do it? I'll give you your directing break, man.
Jeez.
And I directed.
You're like, the mouse that took the thorn out of the lion's paw totally. At this moment.
And this guy was such a great guy. He championed me, and you know, I became untouchable because every time he would meet some record executives or agency people or even the band, he would tell this story about the ice chest, and it always cracked me up because I just thought anybody would have done it, but it just so happened that I was the guy that day. And he literally changed my career because he launched me into music videos now. And I did like, I think 15 music videos over a couple year period there in the end of the 90s, early 2000s.
Wow. Any artists we would know?
No.
All European artists?
Yeah, they would show up and I, you can't see this on the podcast, but I'm extremely white. I'm very pigmentally challenged. And I got into hip hop because I had a knack for hip hop music videos. And I love the music, right? So the artists would get off the plane from, you know, Frankfurt or Berlin and LA, and they'd see me because we'd be there to pick them up. And they're like, wait, where's the music video director?
Like, was ist los? Was ist los mit the white guy here?
So I would direct these music videos. So I did that for a while, and that was super fun. But it was real, you know, not much writing there. You know, it's like, you know, film the car going down the street. Now the artist is singing with a backdrop. And
so you're definitely making a living. You're working hard in a lot of different areas in creative endeavors. You're writing, you're directing. And then this phenomenon happens. How did you get into the world of children's books? Where was the connective tissue that got you from making videos and movies and stuff to that place?
It was one really frustrating night in Hollywood, which I'm sure everybody who's in Hollywood
that should
understands.
Be the title of your autobiography, by the way.
One really frustrating night in Hollywood. I had done a movie with A Band Apart, Quentin Tarantino and Lawrence Bender's company.
Sure.
And Quentin and Lawrence had championed me to direct this thing. It was a movie called Stark Raving Mad. It came out in 2002, I believe. And it ended up being a bit of a feathered fish. It was like sort of a comedy heist. Sean William Scott was in it, who's a good friend of mine.
Oh, wow.
Sean is super funny. And yes. It was his first role coming off of Stifler. And he wanted to do something more John Cusack-y, you know?
Right, right.
And he did a great job in the movie. And he was very clever and very funny because I don't know if you've met him in person, but he's super smart.
Yes.
And very academic. Nothing like Stifler. But he did that Spock thing where he played Spock and now he's Spock the rest of his life. Well, now, you know, Sean is Stifler.
Right.
So I was given him this chance to play sort of a wisecracky gang heist runner guy. Anyway, the movie was funny, but not funny enough to be a comedy. It was heisty, but not heisty enough to be a heist. And we were filming when they were doing Snatch. Snatch beat us. It came out before we were done.
Mm.
And I hadn't even seen it. And everybody said, oh, it's just some cheap Guy Ritchie knockoff guy. And it went straight to video. And, you know, it was a good movie, but not a great movie. But right. It's one of those things you just, you know, you have on your resume. When it went to video, this was before it was cool to go to video. It was like, oh, no. I went home and I was like, you know what? I'm going to get back to kids writing. Because I had sort of drifted away through the music videos and ended up the thing with A Band Apart. And I wrote, I was frustrated. So I wrote, what am I going to write about? And I looked around my office and it's like, there's a computer. Kids don't care about the computer. There's my sack of bills. It's going to keep mom and dad up all night.
The night the bills attacked.
Oh my God. Yeah. Sometimes I'll ask kids at school when I'm doing a school visit, like, hey, would you like a bedtime story about your mom and dad's bills? And you see all the teachers like facepalm.
Of course.
But there's a box of crayons on my desk. I didn't even have kids yet. At this point, I was like 30 something, early 30s.
Which begs the question, why did you have a box of crayons on your desk?
I don't know. I don't know where it came from. As a matter of fact, because it's radio, I have it here so everybody can see it. I have the box of crayons right
in
front of me.
Yes, they're gorgeous. You've had them bronzed. I think that's a lovely keepsake.
The goal is to get them next to Winnie the Pooh at the museum in Washington.
Right.
I just wrote that they were quitting, and I wrote them, and originally it wasn't very child friendly as much as it was more like letters of resignation, and I had to sort of tone it down and bring it to, instead of being adult humor, like about, you know, quitting work and water cooler stuff, down to like
from you children. Venting about your professional frustrations.
Totally.
To something kids would actually enjoy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I sent it to one agent because I didn't know anybody in children's literature. I'd been in Hollywood for at that point, like 15 years almost. And the one agent responded, and Jeff Dwyer, great guy, crusty and ready to retire, and he'd seen it all, done it all. He'd been a pretty serious agent since the 70s. He goes, all right, I'll represent you, kid, but don't call me all the damn time. He's like, if I haven't called you, I haven't sold it. So if you call me, it's just going to frustrate me and piss you off, and just leave me alone. I'll go sell the thing. And he's like, you can clearly dot your I's and cross your T's. Now just leave me alone. I'll go sell it. 6 years later.
6 years later.
He calls me and he's like, I sold it. I'm like, who the hell is this?
And you sold what?
What did you sell? He's like, it's Jeff. And he reacquaints me with it. I'm like, oh, well, I just.
You literally hadn't talked to him for over those 6 years?
Yeah, like once or twice, maybe.
That's
and
crazy.
I had forgotten about it because I gave up on that. That dream died in my basement. You know,
it's sure.
But, you know, my day job was screenwriting. So it's not like things were bad.
Right.
But, you know, he sold it and he said, you know, we got Philomel on board and Oliver Jeffers is the illustrator. And that's big news in publishing. But to me, it was like, blah, 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 blah. I don't know any of those. I didn't. But it's like the Hollywood equivalent of somebody saying, you know, Warner Brothers is doing it. David Fincher's directing. You're off to the races. I didn't realize that. And then the book came out and, you know, exploded.
It literally was a phenomenon. It's so funny, you know, having a kid, Olivia's just turned 9. And so I went through all those years with her in preschool and elementary school. And there are some books that are omnipresent. It seems like every kid has it under their arm or has read it or loves it. And the day the crayons quit was that book. It was everywhere amongst Olivia and her friends. That's the first time I was introduced to you. And she wanted it. And we read it together. And I would read it to her and do the voices of the different crayons. And the writing is so clever and so enjoyable on so many levels. She loved it, but it's the kind of book that a parent doesn't mind reading over and over again because it's so entertaining. And that's to your credit. I mean, that must be the reaction you get from everybody.
Well, it is. And it's been wonderful. I mean, when I studied children's literature at Emerson College, I had a teacher named Jack Gantos, and all your librarian fans just went, what? Jack Gantos, he's won the Newbery, and he's a sort of a middle grade, which is like the early reader, not early reader, but it's a middle grade. It's like those early novels, the chapter books.
Right.
He's done wonders with those, and he's an amazing writer. He was my teacher in college and my advisor, my faculty advisor.
Mm.
And I told him, I said, hey, I'm going to go to Hollywood. This is reversing back to 92 now.
Right.
And he's like, no, don't. I'm like, what do you mean don't? This is my whole plan, man. He's like, no, you're a children's book writer. Don't go to Hollywood. He's like, you're making a mistake. You need to go to New York, you know? And I felt like sort of that scene in the Muppet movie where Big Bird's going to New York and then right. Kermit's going the other way. I'm like, oh, which way do I take? But, you know, I was 22 and I knew better than him. So I went to Hollywood.
Of course. Which wasn't a bad decision in retrospect.
No.
It just delayed your ultimate path a little bit.
Yeah. Instead of 23, it was 43. But, you know, it actually ended up being a good thing because the thing that I brought back to children's literature, I think, but because I think this, because people tell me this, is the dialogue.
Mm.
I became a dialogue doctor out here. I was script doctoring. It was most of what I was making my money at.
Right.
And I thought, well, I got to play to my strengths. So when I wrote The Crayons, those are just monologues. And every book I've done since then has been real strong on dialogue or monologue.
But also very strong on character development. Each of those crayons has a unique point of view and its own voice. And there's nothing homogenous about any of those characters. They all stand alone. And that is such a pleasure to read as a parent when you're reading kids' books, you know, that there's actual story development and there's real characters. And as you mentioned, dialogue. What was the initial reaction when the book went on sale? Was it immediate success?
It was. 2 weeks after it was out, it was on the New York Times bestseller list at number 2.
Wow.
It was crazy.
That must have been a shock to the system.
It was. I was sitting at Chipotle. It's those moments, you know, those weird moments in life when you get really good news.
Right.
And I happened to be sitting at Chipotle with my nephew and my son, and my editor and my publisher call, and they're like, hey, good news, you're now a New York Times bestselling author. And I was like, wow. And then, you know, someone's like, number 3 is ready. You know, so I'm over there trying to eat my carnitas, and I can't.
You said, I'm number 2. I'm not number 3.
Wait a minute. You got it wrong.
Now, I'm not familiar with the world of publishing, so help me out here. How does that happen? How does a book go from hitting the shelves to rocketing up the chart? I don't understand. Is it word of mouth? Is it publicity? Did the publishers do a really good job of getting the word out there? How do they get it into the hands of the people who love it so much?
It's alchemy and magic. You know, yeah. It's the same as movies. You know, you don't know how a TV show. So, I mean, you know, it's usually a combination. So
right.
I think in our case, it's librarians loved it. Educators really gravitated to it. So they're reading it in their classroom. Kids love it. And then they're going home, mom, dad, I want the book.
Right.
I think it was a little bit viral that way. But it was a little bit of lightning in the bottle. I mean, you know, I would love to say, oh, well, if you allow me to pull down this chart and here's a formula. And
the DeWalt program is now available for purchase.
Yeah, I'd like to say I meant it all and every book's going to be exactly that good. But instead, I told the publisher, like an idiot, I was like, well, that's the best one. So, you know.
See you later.
Yeah, just keep publishing my crap now. But he was like, no, no, no. He's like, that's, he's like, you're going to do fine. But, it was a heck of a rocket ride because it instantly became, I became because my picture's in the book in the back and about the author.
Right.
I would be standing at Starbucks or McDonald's or whatever at the mall. And there'd be a little tug on my shirt and I'd look down and there's like some 4-year-old or so saying, crayon man.
Wow.
And then a mom or dad inevitably would come up and apologize. Like, I'm so sorry. I don't know what he's doing. I'm so sorry. I'm like, well, just so, you know, I'm not going to hang the kid out to dry. I think what he's saying is he saw me in the crayon book and then they go, ah, the crayon book. And it's just usually really nice.
That's,
you know,
awesome.
It doesn't happen so often that I, you know, I can't, you know, get to my Chipotle burrito, but but it is nice once in a while.
Paparazzi isn't bothering you yet.
No, I'm okay.
That's good.
But
then the book is such a huge success. Like any good Hollywood story, they demanded a sequel from you, right? And did you have an idea already for one, or did they come to you and say, Drew, we got the golden goose here. Let's lay some more eggs.
That's what they said. Yes. I said producer. You get indoctrinated.
Exactly.
Into
yeah.
My publisher calls and says, you know, this is like 3 months into now we've made, I think, number 1 on the New York Times bestseller list.
And what year is this now? To give me some perspective.
2013.
Okay.
So 13, this is mid 13, end of 13, the publisher calls and says, hey, do you got an idea for a sequel? I'm like, actually, no. I scribbled this thing out and I worked on it and we got it done. And it was kind of a one-off. I don't even know. And he's like, oh, he was obviously bummed because publishers love sequels and money.
Right.
And I was going to give them neither. And I said, but when I think of something, he's like, yeah, call me when you get something. So I don't know, literally like within the month, I'm walking downstairs early morning, got my robe on and got my coffee in my mug. And I'm just walking across our apartment and there's, you know, we have beige, light beige carpet and we've got a pug dog who likes to eat things he's not supposed to. And I walk up and there's this like disgusting hairy pile of dog vomit.
Aww.
With crayons in it. And I'm staring at it and it's the wheels are starting to turn. I'm like, how is this a book? And my wife comes in and she's like, what's wrong? What are you doing? I'm like, oh, Sam got into the crayons and he puked on the rug. And she's like, all right, I'll get the cleaner. And they're like, no, wait. Oh my God, that's my next book. And she's like, good, then you can clean it up. So I was like, okay, if these crayons are pissed about how they're being used, how's that guy feel? He's right. been through a dog's intestines, you know, or right. a stomach at least. So I thought, okay, what other crayons have been wrong? So the crayons that are lost, broken, under the couch, you know, the back of the car, somebody put them in the freezer, you know, it's that the kid stuff. You
right.
know? And,
yeah.
and these were universal stories too. So that's how book two came about.
Is there a plan for a third book? Do you have an idea for the trilogy? As book, a true Star Wars fan,
you got to do it. Yeah.
Thinking in trilogies.
Yeah. I'm hoping that it doesn't have any Ewoks in it either. So
the return of the crayons,
it's called, Crayons Christmas.
Oh, and, perfect.
Originally it was going to be about the crayons going out to dinner with Duncan. He's going to take his crayons out to eat and they can't decide. So they're all just, you know, bitching at him about what food he's trying to pick. And he says, go restaurant to restaurant. And we scrapped that idea when we like the idea that the children love the letters, you know.
Yeah.
And there was a book in the 80s called The Jolly Postman. Did you know about it? I didn't. Mm-mm. I think we're in a generation that missed it, I think. Because no. if you were a kid in like 84, you probably knew about it.
Hmm.
It was a it was a big book. And it was about the postman going through fairy tale land. And he was delivering packages to like the Big Bad Wolf and Grandma and the Three Pigs. And it sort of combined it. It's like
a little clever
fractured fairy tale style.
Right.
But the cool part about this book is that the top of the pages, every other page opened like an envelope. And you could reach in and get the letter he had just given to the person and read the letter. You'd have the physical letter in your hand.
Wow.
And they had, a board game and a poster and little pieces of things, you know, little gamey things. Hmm. And it was a big hit. And those people are all now parents. And when I say it to someone who's probably in their 30s, they go, oh my gosh, I remember Jolly Postman. Ah, and it's one of their books. It's that generation's book.
Right.
So we decided it'd be cool if the crayons wrote letters for Christmas and they could, the kids could take out the pieces, you know? So we got like a paper doll and board game and it's all crayon themed. So,
and this is stuff the crayons won for Christmas. Is it like their wish list or?
Well, it's, I don't want to give anything away,
okay, yeah. but it's too much.
Yeah.
No spoilers.
But it's, you know, I will say that it's the moment when, cause Duncan's given so much to them,
right.
our main character in the first two books where he gives them self-satisfaction and then he gives them a home.
He builds that great house for him at the end of the second book.
Yeah. Yep. And now the crayons want to do something nice for him.
Oh, that's sweet.
So, yeah.
And then, not to jump too quickly through your incredible body of work, but my personal favorite, The Legend of Rock, Paper, and Scissors. Just, you know, at this point, we had become a fan of your work and then you and I had sort of connected. And when I heard about the idea for this book, it seemed like I couldn't believe no one had thought of this idea before. For you to take Rock, Paper, and Scissors, which every kid knows and loves and plays and has for generations, to write an origin story for those three characters was amazing. It was brilliant. Oh. And yet so very simple.
Thanks. Well, you know, it's one of those, you know, the shower ideas or driving to work ideas.
Right.
You're like, oh, this is going to make me my $1 million. And you don't get those often. And one of them was my crayons book, I thought, because I couldn't believe no one had really done a really solid crayons as characters story.
Right.
There had been a couple attempts. So I Googled Rock, Paper, Scissors book, Rock, Paper, Scissors children's book. I Googled it and I went on Amazon and I searched there. I thought, someone has to have done this. What I did find, though, is there's a guide on how to win. Now, that's a person with a brilliant idea. That idea came to me. I actually, what was it? It's a very glamorous Hollywood story. I don't know. I guess I can lay it on you guys. So I'm driving to Costco in the minivan with my kids in the backseat.
Like a big star.
Yeah. Abigail is my daughter and my son's Reese. And I'm hearing them going, 1, 2, 3, go. And then Abby will go, yeah, in your face. And Reese is like, oh, this game sucks. And then they do it again. 1, 2, 3, go. And Reese is like, I knew it. So I turn the rearview mirror and I'm like, are you guys playing Rock, Paper, Scissors? And my daughter goes, yeah, Dad, it's this new game we invented at school.
Every generation thinks they discovered it, right?
It's great. And I said, you know, if you ask Grandma, she'll play you that game. And they're like, what? How does she know about our new game? And that was super enlightening to me because every generation thinks you did it. You know, right. You think, oh, this is, we've invented this amazing thing. And so I thought, oh, that's a book. So I thought, what I'll do is I'll actually find the origin story and see where it came from. But after a lot of research, and by a lot of research, I mean not that much, but enough.
A cursory glance at Wikipedia.
Yeah, I went to Wiki and they didn't have it. So, I got to write my own. No, but they had, it originated in three continents almost simultaneously, it looks like. Africa, Europe, and Asia.
They all developed their own version of it around the same time.
It's three part. Each thing beats itself circularly. And I read about one. It's Wiki, so take it for what it's worth. Yeah. But I read about one in Asia where it's frog, slug, fox. The fox eats the frog. The frog eats the slug. And the slug grosses out the fox. And kids love that one. And I don't know what the hand signals are for it. But like these are like 500, 600,000 year old, you know, games.
Wow.
And I think the African one is like river, forest, mountain or something like that. And but it's all three. And then there were songs in ancient Ireland that were like work songs that the kids would do because kids worked.
Sure.
And they were trinary and they would sing like in rotation and there's a call and response.
Oh, wow.
You know, and you could win the song. Anyway, and I thought, okay, I can't put all that together. So I'm just going to make something up about the backyard.
And for those who have read the book, if you've got kids, you've read it. It's just the epic tale. It's just written in such a perfect encapsulation of a genre piece so that grown-ups can enjoy sort of the epic warrior battle aspect of it. And the kids just love the characters. And Olivia especially loves the fact that Scissors is represented as this kick-ass female character, because there's not, in my opinion, as the father of a daughter, not enough of those in children's fiction. And so she especially loves the fact that Scissors gets in there and does some damage.
That one was for my daughter. You know, I wanted her to have something. Because, you know, we actually thought of making all three female characters for a while, but then it got really sort of glow-y. Glow for kids. But I thought, no, let's not take that. Let's not go that far. But, you know, Scissors being a master swordswoman would be cool.
Yeah. And there is a Conan quality to Rock, too, which I just enjoy so much. And full disclosure, Drew was kind enough to come to my kids' school and talk to the kids there in the library. And we had a chance to read the book out loud. And I won't say, but maybe I did a little Schwarzenegger when I was reading the role of Rock. Maybe a little bit. So what's on the docket now? What's next for you? Besides the third Crayons book, what else can we look forward to from you?
I just did a book for Pixar.
Oh, my goodness.
Based on the Toy Story 4 character Forky.
Oh, yeah. And Forky has been talked about quite a bit with the release, the little dribs and drabs we're getting of video from the upcoming film. But yeah, Forky's he doesn't belong there, apparently. At least he doesn't think he does.
No,
he's not a toy. He's telling everybody.
Oh, it's a funny. I got to see an early cut of the film last year.
Oh, how is it?
Fantastic.
Oh, that's great.
And it's Toy Story. So
yeah, right.
It's amazing. And then you've got this sort of reluctant new toy and Woody's got to escort him along. I don't want to get killed by the Pixar.
No, they will take you
agents,
out.
So I won't give away too much.
There's a red laser dot on your forehead right now. I don't even know where that's coming in from.
The book takes place like it would be like the day after the movie.
Oh, gotcha.
So it's, you know,
companion piece.
Yeah. It's nice. And it's something that the kids can read and take home. And Forky's hilarious. So I'm looking forward to seeing what kids think of that one.
Any new ideas from your own brain that aren't someone else's?
Property? Actually, yeah, those are fun too, though.
No, of course, it's nice to play in someone else's sandbox.
Totally, to get to write in the it's funny because it was a little bit of a return home because I had done Buzz Lightyear of Star Command.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So coming back to that, those characters and that dialogue was really fun. Again, dialogue. That's one of the reasons that they brought me on. I think that the producer and the director's children had been reading crayons and they thought, oh, anthropomorphic objects. Let's get this guy. So yeah. I'm the anthropomorphic object guy now, which I'm fine with. I'll make anything talk. The newest thing I have is called Monkey and Cake. And it's about two best friends and they're sort of Frog and Toad or Bert and Ernie. And it's a early reader series. So the kids can actually pop it open and start reading themselves because it's real simple. It's, you know, but it's philosophy for kids because these two argue philosophy. Like the first one is Schrodinger's cat. There's a one has, it's called, you know, What's in the Box? Not Gwyneth Paltrow's head. I know what you're thinking. I saw it on your face. What's in the box?
What's in the box?
I'm waiting for those memes, actually.
They'll come. It's the internet.
Yeah, have fun, guys. But they argue about what's in the box, and Monkey says it's a cat, and you know, Cake says, well, I want to see it because I love kitty cats, and they open the box, and there's no, or no, actually, they don't open the box. Monkey explains that if you do open the box, there's no cat inside, and then they get into an argument, and Cake says, well, I think it's a dinosaur, and I think it's a cake, and then they wander off to get lunch, because that's how philosophy is.
Right, exactly.
I think that I wanted, with this series, it's an early reader, I get to do dialogue, and also I get to introduce kids to really complex philosophical precepts and concepts,
right? So you can lay that foundation for later on in life.
Yeah, and then sometime in, you know, they're when they're doing their thesis, when they're 22 or 23, they're like, wait a minute, this is Monkey and Cake.
Yeah, when they're trying to wrap their head around some complex philosophical idea, they go, wait a minute, I know this.
Yeah, I'll hit up evolution in this series. I'm gonna hit up Sartre, Hell is Other People. You know, I'm trying to get into that whole, you know,
going back to the classics for children's literature. That's a great idea.
Yeah. So those three of those come out this year.
Wow. Sounds like you have a full plate, sir.
It's been very busy. It's been a very busy time, and I'm very blessed because, you know.
I have to think, with your background in motion pictures and television also, that there must be some interest in taking these books or these characters and developing a series or a movie or something based on this stuff, right? Have you been entertaining offers?
Initially, Universal picked up Crayons a couple years ago, and they were going to make a movie, and then they couldn't get their head around it as far as what kind of movie it was going to be. Because at the end of the day, when I hand a picture book, especially a book like Crayons, which is mostly character development and dialogue,
right,
I'm not giving them a really strong plot for a 90-minute movie. So they wrestle with the plot, and right now it's actually over at Sony with Sean Levy.
Oh, great.
Old friend of mine. So it was fun. I, you know, because of the weight of the Crayons project, I got to pick the producer, and I'm like, let's get Sean, you know, and he's at Fox. So Sony said, well, let's see if we can make the deal. And Sean was like, Sean didn't know I'd written it. He'd been reading it to his kids.
No way.
And he's like, holy crap, that's you. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, I never looked at the name. I'm like, well, thanks a lot. I guess I'm not going to look at the credits for Stranger Things anymore. I'm just going to move on to the next video, like they say to.
Doesn't that annoy you on Netflix? That bugs me when the credits start to roll and they go 3 seconds till next episode. I was like, can I just finish watching the whole program,
relax,
please?
We're binging already.
Yes.
Give me a minute.
How quickly do you have to jam it in my face?
The poor prop master never gets seen.
Exactly. Well, that's great that they're working on that. And I guess I could see your point is that it is not plot heavy in retrospect, but I guess there's a way to crack that nut. I mean, I would think you just...
Well, it's in the title. They quit.
Yeah, you know, right.
There they go. They're going to quit.
There's
your verb. And then there's an odd thing. And then they come home at the end.
Right, yeah.
I think that they're gonna hit it eventually, you know, because it's definitely worthy of an animated series, I think.
And how about Rock, Paper, and Scissors? It seems like they would have that would be a great story. I mean, that's got a plot. I mean,
well, that does.
That's a hero's journey right there with those three.
That's right out of my Joseph Campbell handbook.
Exactly.
On the Many Faces of Man, or Myths of Man, whatever that one was. I'm going to break the news. Why not?
What?
Well, they can't fire me now. We
Breaking
already sold it.
Story.
Yeah, we sold Rock, Paper, Scissors to Netflix. I'm producing it myself. This one I'm going to do myself.
Congratulations. Yeah, that is awesome.
I mean, you know, we still got to jump through the first episode writing hoop and the pilot hoop and all that. But, you know, the ground has been broken, and Netflix, they just have a great creative team. And they, as soon as I walked in and pitched it, they got it. Like, when I wrote Rock, Paper, Scissors, I had, you're going to know the name of this guy a bit, but I don't know. He's the narrator from Conan. The John Milius, the 70s Schwarzenegger Conan. And it was the Asian wizard.
Yes.
And I can't remember his name. He also did the voice of Aku in Samurai Jack. Fantastic actor.
It's
but he talked like
now.
This.
I know
exactly. It was a time of blood and iron.
Yes, or, you know, I know. I know exactly what you're talking
about.
But
that's the voice I had when I was writing. I was like, it was a time of legend and darkness, you know?
Right, right.
I think we'll have something like that going on, and it'll be that Conan theme. Dum, 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 dum,
oh,
dum,
man. I'm excited. I can't wait. That sounds awesome. Well, and we have a scoop. I think you're our first scoop here on the Ralph Report. So
well, there you go. Well,
thank you so much
for
that. If
it doesn't go, then you know they fired me for scooping.
I'm sure they won't, because it's a great idea, and I'm sure it's going to be a big hit for Netflix, just like it was for you. And
it's such a pleasure to have you here, and thank you so much for doing this, man. You're a good guy and a good friend, and you know I'm a fan of your work, so just keep knocking them out of the park, sir.
Thanks, man. Good to be here.